From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Colin Donovan. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
All right, welcome again to Open Line Friday here on EWTN Radio. Jack Williams is away. I'm Tom Price. Glad to be with America's favorite theologian, Colin Donovan. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good, Tom. How about yourself?
Doing very well.
Excellent.
You're still... In your undisclosed location, right? You're in the bunker?
Yeah, I'm in the bunker waiting for the Fourth World War. I may have a long time waiting, but we'll be all right.
Well, we're over in about an hour, so
hopefully. Okay, well.
Hopefully all will go well in the next hour or so. If you have questions, I'm sure we'll make it through. If you have questions for Colin Donovan of a theological bent, we would love to hear from you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Also, if you're listening outside of North America, please dial the U.S. country code and then a special phone number just for folks like you, 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000, wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Can you send us an email? Anytime you want, 24 hours a day, openline@ewtn.com, openline@ewtn.com. Make sure that you put either theology or Colin or Friday in the subject line. Speaking of which, Colin, we're going to lead off with a very interesting question here from Kent.
Okay.
Who says, why is there such a hostile feeling between the ordinary form and extraordinary form mass? I see so many times where ordinary form supporters saying, quote, we can't go back, only forward. Yet those supporting the extraordinary form mass supports the historical organic growth of the mass and explain that the ordinary form of the mass stripped away our growth to go back to the original mass, thus countering their own argument of not going backwards. So what are your thoughts on this, Colin?
Well, my thoughts on this are, I think, what the thoughts of a good theological position is, and that is ultimately these questions are a decision of the magisterium. The liturgy is Christ. The Pope and the bishops have the responsibility to Christ for their custody. People can argue about how well they fulfill that, but they will be responsible for it. I think what the purpose is, and we tend to forget that going back to the middle of the 1800s, there began to be a deep appreciation of the theological basis of our forms of the liturgy. And of course, this would be the pre-Vatican II forms as such existed then. And of those forms and the study of them producing an understanding of the principles of liturgical prayer. And the same happened with looking at the old sacramentaries that will go back as far back as Pope Gregory the Great and even Pope Leo. So, and also we see certain medieval developments, since Trent codified the Mass of Rome, but there were other forms of the liturgy during the Middle Ages by religious groups and by dioceses. So studying all of that, it is clear that there are certain principles that run through all the liturgy. And so the Council wanted to take advantage of that over a century of study. Inspired also by ideas from the previous papacies, especially Pius XII on liturgical matters, and to go back somewhat, not anachronistically to the early church, but rather look at those principles and see what will be a pastoral advantage in the church today. And so out of this effort, good or bad as one may have an opinion of it, came the ordinary form. Now, as Cardinal Ratzinger, then Pope Benedict, pointed out that there was a sort of a mistake that the customary forms were practically, for all practical purposes, suppressed. And so he restored the exercise of those customary forms. And there are many people who grew up with that and are very attached for it. And so it's a case of, you know, why are you, to use the vernacular, dissing somebody else's desires, somebody else's, what they prefer in terms of the liturgy? Yes, the church itself must come to what accommodations to make, how in the future these things will progress together. Pope Benedict spoke on that and wrote on that in his Motu Proprio and elsewhere regarding sort of not an interpenetration so much as that we learn from each other. The two forms would learn and grow together so that the old was preserved and that the new and the new pastoral situation of now the 21st century could be used to advantage to reach out to people. And so the prudential arguments will be there. The authority arguments are settled because it was the church that did this and not the people, right, not the lower clergy, and not even an individual bishop. You know, so I think pox, everybody should be at peace.
Sure.
There's no reason to attack somebody else's preferences since you favor the older forms. And I think that's the way to deal with it, while encouraging exactly what Pope Benedict asked us to do, and that is see what is beautiful and what is advantageous in each, because ultimately the forms themselves are under the authority of the church. There is no such thing as a discipline. There is a disciplinary tradition, liturgical tradition, and so on, but the principles are unchanging. The forms that result from those principles can change, and they have changed. They're uh-huh. different in all of the liturgical rites, and we have to acknowledge that, and we have to acknowledge that those forms, those disciplines, those practices are under the authority of the magisterium and not our own.
And I think you would agree that any kind of a triumphalistic attitude on anybody's part is not going to be helpful, is it?
Right, and that's certainly not most of the traditionalists I know. But there are, of course, many who go and there's really dumb conclusions. You know, the Holy See is vacant. Vatican II was false. Some would go back to Pius XII. Some would go back to Pius V. These are ridiculous extreme positions. But I think, yes, there are hard feelings on both sides. You have, you might say, ultra progressives who could find nothing good in the way the Mass was celebrated in the past. And then you can find the same, the other spectrum among traditional people who can find no good or pastoral advantage in the new forms.
Very good. Ken, thank you so much for your email. Zach wants to know, did Christians in the New Testament fight for religious freedom, or did they just practice their faith no matter what the government did?
More or less the latter. Yeah. If you think about it, the rule of law was also the rule of force. It was a very Darwinian society. So those who have such great love for Darwin and evolution and think that that's the end all and be all should look at ancient societies and see what, you know, might makes right produces. Those are good examples of where we will go if we adopt that kind of thinking. Christ gave us the gospel as a leaven, as he himself said, and it took a number of centuries. In fact, you could say the job is not done, and in many ways has been reversed, to transform the society, not by force of arms or force of law, but by the change of hearts. And so the church practiced her faith even where it was contrary to the customs and the laws of the time. And we should do the same.
Okay. And real quick here before we go to break, this is from Frederick in Ireland. Could you please explain what Pope Francis intended by the Year of Mercy back in 2016?
Well, you can read the document that he published on it. What he intended was that we pay a particular attention to the divine mercy. And that the church become an instrument of that mercy. In the 20th century, we have not only the revelations to Sister Faustina Kowalska in Krakow, Poland, and prior to that in Lithuania, but we have the advancement of that and promotion of that under Pope St. John Paul II. And so you can combine with the message of Fatima, I think the message of divine mercy, to see that our time is a time of mercy for the world, a time of Our Lady. Christ's time will be a time of justice. So we can We can either adhere to the mercy of God, or we should better prepare for his justice. And I think the Pope was bringing into relief that this is a time of mercy, such as spoken by in the mystics, such as Pope John Paul II and others in the 20th century had already stated and promoted.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you so much for that question. If you have a question you would like to submit to us via email for a future show, we'd love to hear from you. Openline@EWTN.com is the address. Openline@EWTN.com is the address. Again, please put Friday or Colin or theology in the subject line. When we return, we'll be talking with William in Charlotte, North Carolina, Nancy in Dickinson, North Dakota, Chad in Mason, Ohio. I know where that is. Lots more straight ahead here on Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan on EWTN. Do stay with us.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@EWTN.com.
Hey, be sure to join us on Monday evening for The Journey Home with Marcus Grodi. This week, Marcus welcomes Sister Miriam James Heidland. She tells us how she reverted back to the Catholic faith. A lot of people do that. They will step away from the faith for whatever reason, for a period of time, and then one day they wake up and they go, hang on, wait a minute. There's that Catholic thing. I need to learn more about that. Maybe I was kind of a dodo when I was a younger person. I know that, well, anyway, I won't even get into that. I was about to say something about my wife, who often calls herself a dodo for leaving the Catholic faith and then returning. Thanks be to God. Anyway, we'll find out Sister Miriam's story on Monday night at 8 p.m. Right. Eastern, right here on EWTN Radio and Television. Today, we're talking with Colin Donovan, answering your questions on all things theology. And if you're ready, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN.
Sure.
We begin with Nancy. Nancy is in the great Dickinson, North Dakota. I've been to Dickinson. It is gorgeous. She's listening on Real Presence Radio. Hey, Nancy, what's on your mind today? Nancy is a little busy at the moment.
Okay.
Why don't we go over to William in Charlotte, North Dakota, North Carolina, rather, listening on YouTube, a first-time caller. William, what's on your mind today? We may have some phone issues.
Uh-oh.
All right.
That sounds more technical difficulty.
It kind of does. Why don't we try to figure those things out? In the meantime, we're going to get to a question from Ron in Mattoon, Illinois, listening online, EWTNradio.com. Here's what Ron had to say. The saints in heaven have free will, but cannot sin. There are some, Jimmy Akins and Akin and Dr. Anders, who have said they believe Mary is impeccable based on Mary's fullness of grace as the new Eve being the perfection of the old Eve. Well, it has been something that I have pondered, but I'm still not sure. It also doesn't make total sense to me as well. Could you please help me understand this, Colin?
Sure. It's not that Jimmy Akin and Dr. Anders think that. The Catholic Church thinks that and teaches that.
Okay.
Mary is without sin.
All right.
So they're on solid ground, and I won't have to issue a monitum against those two fellows after the show is
over. Oh, good.
So we're good to go on that one.
Yay.
So what the Church believes is that Mary was given, in the fullness of grace, everything that was necessary. She had to dispose her will, but she did dispose her will such that she never sinned. Now, never sin doesn't mean that you know all things. What is a sin? Is it deliberately doing something, if a mortal sin, committing a deliberately grave fault? Does anybody believe Our Lady committed a mortal sin? I don't think so. A venial sin comes with moral fault if there is some imperfection in our will when we make some decision. Now, imperfections can come from knowledge. It can come from our own moral weakness. You know, I really shouldn't eat that extra bowl of ice cream, but, you know, it's only one bowl of ice cream. Oh, why not? You know?
Yeah.
And so that's not a mortal sin, but there's certainly lacking perfection in such an attitude. So what Mary could not do was choose even those deliberate moral faults. We see that she is capable of, say, deficiency of knowledge. She says to Christ at Cana, they have no wine. He says, woman, it's not my time. But what does he do? He accepts what she said as his mother, and he does it anyway. And so in some mysterious way, ignorant of some aspect of the divine plan that she would think that it could start today, in this situation of need that she wished to be merciful and have her son act mercifully, she instigated, as it were, the public ministry and the public miracles of her son. There was no deliberate choice. Well, I know God doesn't want this, but I'm going to tell him anyway. There was none of that.
Yeah.
It was an error of knowledge, and it was indeliberate. In other words, it was, you might say, against some absolute standard. That's not what God wanted in that moment. But when she had expressed that desire, he did it. So it's not morally wrong. He couldn't have done it if it was morally wrong. And so he did it. So that's what the church is saying. She was human. She had the deficiencies of knowledge and foresight that we all have. But in the choice, moral choices she were made, they were without fault subjectively, because they were always efforts to be pleasing to God 100%. And so that's what the church is claiming. And if you think about it, I made this analogy a few weeks ago as well, that from all eternity, God chose to send his son into the world, even before the universe existed. There's nothing he didn't know about what would happen when he created, and the angels would fall, and Adam and Eve would fall. There was nothing he didn't know about that. But from all eternity, knowing that and willing the incarnation, he also willed the woman whose physical human nature would be given to the Word incarnate. You think about that. The body, the nature of Mary was given to Christ. And so in anticipation of that, he prepared and disposed everything that was necessary to make her cooperation with his plan perfect. And so he did.
Okay. And there we are. Thank you so much for your question. It is Open Line Friday here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Network. Just got a very interesting text here from, let me scroll up just a little bit, Marshall in Columbus, Ohio. Marshall wants to know, could recycling be considered a form of almsgiving?
No, I think it's a form of doing something. We have a responsibility for the environment. That can take many forms.
Uh-huh.
That means that we know that the environment is not ours to own or destroy, but rather it's God given to us in trust, and we have to make a good use of it. Certainly, I think recycling fits into that to the extent that it's practical and workable and, you know, and so on and so forth. But in that sense, to the extent that we do it, we're doing it trying to fulfill that duty. And I think generally when we do duties, yes, God sees that and is pleased and will reward us in some way. But I don't think we should consider it, you know, Jesus, what did he say? Well done, good and faithful servant. Well, we're trying to be good and faithful stewards.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be seeking credit for every good and faithful thing that we do. God will give the credit, but that ought not to be our primary motive.
Oh, very good. Here's one now, a question from William watching us on YouTube today. What would be some good books for someone who is new to theology to read? I have read Fulton Sheen and Chesterton as well. Any thoughts there, Colin?
Yeah, I think probably a book that many people have read, and it's now getting to be an old book, is that of Frank Sheed's Theology for Beginners.
Oh, yeah.
As sort of an introduction. Now, there are deeper books you can get into. I know in my own progress in that, you know, eventually come around to Dr. Ludwig Ott's dogmatic theology book, which gives in great detail the history of theology. But that's pretty, I think, far down the road for most people. You get a grasp by reading something like Sheed. If you want to know how to read scripture in that, you're going to read Pope Benedict's Jesus of Nazareth, where his introductions are just superb. Superb instruction on the theology of the scriptures. Every Catholic should read those introductions to that introduction of Jesus of Nazareth. I think the best one is in the first book. He has a two-volume set. So things like that, you can get into the Summa of Thomas Aquinas. You can get into obviously something like Ott. The most important thing is always to remember, and it's something that Aquinas always remembered, and that is theology doesn't create the faith. It explains the faith. Mm. And so ultimately, what we believe is not what is in a theology book. It's what is in the teaching books of the church.
Sure. Okay.
In councils and in the popes and in the catechism of the Catholic Church as a summary.
Okay.
That's our faith. The other is an explanation of it.
Very good. Here's a question now from John watching us on YouTube. How do I best choose a spiritual director? I am discerning religious life in the future, but there really are no priories within hours of me. Would a diocesan priest be less ideal for my direction than a religious priest or brother? I'm specifically looking into the Dominican order. Thank you so much.
It's hard to say, but let me say this. As a general matter, any priest who understands how to do spiritual direction, in other words, he knows the teaching of the church and knows about discerning a vocation, which is presuming that he had to do that discernment himself, and has some practical experience in guiding others, is somebody that you can approach. Because after all, you're making an assumption which is not valid yet, and that is that you have a call to the Dominicans or Redemptorists or secular clergy or whatever it is. And that you don't know. The idea of discernment is what is the will of God, you know, not whether I'm going to have pizza or pie or, you know, ice cream. That's a second stage or even a third stage. You're discerning what is the will of God for me in my life, what vocation should I follow, and having discerned a call to the religious life and priesthood, that somebody who knows you can say, yes, I think you're in solid ground here, then to proceed to making judgments, determinations like that. Now, some fall into it very naturally. Some of them go through a more complicated discernment. Maybe you feel deep in your heart already. But I still think a secular priest would, who understands vocation, would be able to help you. And pick a pious priest. That's always a good antidote against nonsense.
Okay. And real quick, before we go to break, Mary wants to know, is there a specific prayer for someone who is struggling with intense guilt and shame from things that they have done?
I think the Chaplet of Divine Mercy and the Mercy Prayers generally, we were talking about the Divine Mercy earlier, and Sister Faustina in her diary and the devotional practices that have come about because of those revelations of our Lord to her, the Chaplet, the Mercy Prayers, the little Mercy booklet, which the Marians of the Immaculate Conception in Stockbridge can send out to you. These things are all, I think, big helps in coming to know that God is merciful, because it sounds like the biggest problem is really trusting that he is merciful, and there's not some trap door somewhere where if I don't do it perfectly right, I'm somehow lost. No, God is merciful. He's generous. He's the one who wants to forgive you more than you want to forgive yourself.
Sure. So if you've properly confessed that sin and it's been absolved, you're good to go, right?
That's right. A lot of this is emotional, getting that emotional balance. And that's a change of heart and a change of mind that you are forgiven. And I think knowing how the Divine Mercy behaves toward us is a good way to learn that.
There you go. Mary, thank you so much for your wonderful question. Got lots more straight ahead on this Friday edition of Open Line here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Network. Do stay with us.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Glad you're with us here for this Open Line Friday edition with Colin Donovan on EWTN. Going to take a question now from David, who emailed us a little while back. David says, did the apostles fully understand transubstantiation at the Last Supper, or did it take many years for the church to come to that conclusion?
It didn't take many years. I think they understood this, what our Lord said was true. And you find that in the early fathers of the church, in Ignatius of Antioch, in Justin Martyr, explaining to the emperor, Emperor Pius, regarding the faith that what Christians believe, more or less to show that they weren't a threat to his empire, that we believe this is really Jesus Christ we receive in the Holy Eucharist. And so that was starting with that point. Then what took place in that came about through a period of reflection in the church over the course of about 1,000 years, and coalesced around the terminology of the middle ages. Uh-huh. With I'm not sure whether Peter Lombard, but certainly by Aquinas, this was already the considered explanation of what took place, that all of the substance and all of the, with the exception of the accidents, are changed into the body and blood of Christ. And if you think about it, this makes sense. If there really is bread there, other than as a sign to point, you know, sort of a continuous miracle going on, uh-huh, to point to the reality, then what we attribute to God as God is not just God alone. So what the church gives us is an assurance that that the Eucharist is wholly Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity. And as Thomas Aquinas' beautiful hymn, which we sing in the Tantum Ergo and the O Salutaris, tells us, you know, that in a way the senses are deceived by the signs, and the reality is a reality of faith. And we can make that act of faith. And without that act of faith, we just simply think it's common bread and common wine, and it isn't. It isn't either of those.
Sure. All right. Well, we thank you so much for that. Mary, thank you so much for your email. Actually, that came from David. We got to Mary before the break. It is Open Line Friday here on EWTN. Let's go to a question that we received on our listener comment line now.
Michael, my question is, in the Lord's Prayer, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Does that mean we're going to have heaven on earth, or does that mean we're going to try and make earth like it is in heaven?
Mm-hmm. Well, we can try all we want, but we can't make the earth like heaven. God can at the end of the world. And so in the book of Revelations, it's revealed to the Apostle John that there will be a new heavens and a new earth. So the resurrection which Christ himself experienced, and then which he gave to Our Lady in her assumption and glorification in heaven, will be given to all of the just at the end of the world with the general resurrection. And that same event will be the transformation of the universe, so that you could say the universe is resurrected, spiritualized, and God will be all in all, is as St. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15. So that's something to look forward to. The idea that we can make heaven on earth is a utopian idea, and utopian ideas are usually very dangerous. Marx and Engels had an idea of this: history would advance and progress, and somehow we would all be, you know, everything will be happy. There will be this dictatorship of the working class man. Nietzsche, we're evolving towards kind of a Superman, and that the Superman will be our fate. And you see down through history the Third Reich of Hitler. And you might even say the idea that we can have an absolute social justice without respect, and we can get there with violence and without respecting the dignity of others, without respecting the dignity of the unborn, without respecting the dignity, is pure nonsense. utopian ideas always get the world into trouble. And so it's the seeking of that, which the Catechism tells us, beginning at paragraph 668, that will ultimately leave man to the point of accepting solutions to problems which are completely contrary to God. And that is only when that at that time is when Christ will return, and that will be the end of all things. So utopianism, any kind of messianism, any kind of millenarianism is very dangerous in that it makes people think, ah, if I just work hard enough and change other people, well, I can't change their hearts. So, well, I'll make them do what I want them to do. We're going to have this beautiful, perfect world. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Appreciate that. Thank you so much for your call. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. We're going to get to another question in a moment. But, Colin, you actually jogged my failing memory a few moments ago when you were talking about St. Thomas Aquinas and the fact that he had authored the Tantum Ergo, I believe you mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, today, September 25th, is the feast of Blessed Herman the Cripple. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not.
He lived many, many years ago, but he actually composed two of the most beautiful prayers of the Catholic faith, the Salve Regina and the Alma Redemptoris Mater.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, those are two of my favorite. Those are Marian hymns, which are sung in different seasons of the year, usually at the end of the Liturgy of the Hours, at the end of the day.
Pretty neat.
They've gotten a lot of use over the years.
Absolutely. Open Line, yeah, but he doesn't, but they're not still paying any rights to his estate.
No,
right?
There's no
residuals
probably,
there.
I don't think so. Love to have the copyright of those, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. All right, it's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. I have a question here from James, who emailed us a while back. He says, my question is in regards to the prophets Enoch and Elijah, who never experienced death. Where are Enoch and Elijah now? Are they in heaven? Are we not taught everyone will experience death? Did the Elijah, who never experienced death, meet Christ at his transfiguration? Or are Enoch and Elijah the two of God's prophets in Revelation 11? What do you think, Colin?
Well, I can tell you what the fathers of the church, those who spoke on this, and it's... I guess in some ways it's open to question, but the interpretation of those who address this is that Enoch and Elijah, they didn't die, that they're preserved somewhere, we don't know where, till the final age and the Antichrist comes. I was talking about the seeking of utopia and the adopting of some final solution to the world's problems. It sounds suspiciously like somebody's final solution about 70, 80 years ago, except this time I think it'll be both Christians and Jews probably. And at that time, Enoch and Elijah will come to preach. Elijah to the Jewish people, Enoch to the rest of us. And the Antichrist will slay them in the city of Jerusalem, and they will rise from the dead. So they will die. Now, whether that's simply symbolic, we know that our Lord said to John the Baptist that John the Baptist was Elijah, and he certainly had the spirit of Elijah, probably because he couldn't be Elijah. Elijah is reserved for the end of the world. So we can only take that opinion of the fathers, of those who spoke on the matter. We don't have any better opinion or any better insights. I've gotten no emails from either of these gentlemen telling me I'm wrong. So I guess I'll just repeat what I've read and been told by some of the early fathers of the church. Because beyond that, we know nothing.
Okay, very good. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Why don't we go to another phone call that we received on our listener comment line.
Hello, my name is Al. I'm calling from Indiana. I'm 91 years old. I just got out of the hospital. I've been there for 30 days. The priest gave me communion, and he gave me my last rites. But then I come back out of it, and I'm healthy again. But I have a question. Nobody can read at a mass the gospel. When I was a reader, a lector for 30 years, I accidentally read the Christmas one, and I read it, and I said, oh my God, I never read this before. This is beautiful. But then when I finished, the priest says, Al, you know you read the gospel? And I says, no, I didn't. So anyway, the deacon took the next day's gospel and read it, so he actually read another one. But what happens to me now through accidentally reading that gospel at a mass?
Okay. Well, we were talking about Our Lady and human error earlier, so I think on that point you're still impeccable, Al. No sin was committed, so I think you're good to go.
Wow.
And you got your last rites, but let's hope the Lord doesn't call you soon. Give us a little more time with you here with us.
Absolutely. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Garen is listening in Anchorage, Alaska. Garen says, Jesus in John 3:16 and in John 6:40 says, quote, believe in the name. Well, Protestants use these as proof texts for sola fide. Is Jesus talking in a different context than just belief alone? Does he mean something more or maybe something different from sola fide? What do you think, Colin?
Well, the idea of sola fide means by faith alone that one is saved. There's a lot of evidence in the New Testament to contradict the idea of sola fide. The idea of constantly persevering in the faith until the end, of St. Paul saying that, you know, he feared that having preached to others, he himself would be lost. If there was anybody who had ever had faith, it was St. Paul. How could he say that and mean in one, that in one place and another place be preaching sola fide? No, the church doesn't believe in sola fide, and sola fide is not the solution, because it's quite clear that works have a role in it. We have the kingdom parables in the Gospel of Matthew. We have the virgins. Their lamps are, they have the oil for their lamps or they don't. If they don't, they're excluded. The oil is the oil of charity. If they don't come with charity, then they don't have that. St. James says the same things. I can have faith, but if I have no works, meaning charity, then it's a sounding brass, a gong. And so charity is important. It accompanies faith. In fact, for probably well over 1,000 years, if not back to the beginning, we have the words of St. Paul, certainly in the scriptures, about faith, hope, and love, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Faith means that we believe in God. Hope means that we hope in Him. Well, if we're already saved, why do we need hope?
Yeah.
Charity means that we love God and we love our neighbor for the sake of God, and we have to do that. So there's clearly no sense there in St. Paul or anywhere in the history of the church that we ever believed as a believing people that one could only have faith without hope, because you needed it. If you're already saved, you don't need hope. That's just a fact. I'm saved. That's all there is to it. Story over. Well, let's move on. Do something else. No, we need hope that we can persevere to the end. But hope in God is a certainty that is it also dependent upon faith. And charity, of course, love of God and love of neighbor. And the mark of love is obedience. Obedience to God's commands. That's obedience to the moral law. Obedience to His example in the New Testament. Obedience to what He established and is evidence in the scripture. He established a church with pastors. He established the Eucharist. He established the sacrament of reconciliation established. That too is part of our charity for God, our obedience to God, that we say there is nothing in what you ordained for the salvation of the world or the carrying out of that plan of salvation that I do not love and obey to the best of my ability. That's part of charity. And on all of these things, faith, hope, and love, we will be tested at the end of the world, as the kingdom parables say, when the sheep and the goats are separated. The sheep to come into the kingdom and the goats to go, well, to another place.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Thank you so much for your question. It is Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Hey, if you love this show, if you love the other shows that you hear here on EWTN Radio, we invite you to check out our podcasts. EWTN Radio posts 11 podcasts every weekday. That's a lot of podcasts. And believe it or not, over 60 every week. You'll never miss your favorite EWTN programs, and they're all absolutely free. Just go to EWTN.com/radio/podcasts to listen and subscribe. So if you missed part of today's show, hey, check out the podcast. We usually have those posted within a couple of hours of the time that we go off the air. So it's a wonderful thing. Just got a text from Andrea who says, is my father disqualified from getting into heaven just by being a Methodist minister and not a Catholic?
No, because as I noted earlier, with regard to what sins we're held accountable for, knowledge is part of it. And so the church teaches that, yes, it is the will of God that that we, if we believe in Jesus, that we enter his church, that we participate in the life of that church, but that there are people who, for whatever reason, they don't know that. Mm-hmm. And just going up to somebody, I've had people say, yeah, but I've told my brother, you know, many times, you're not going to be a Catholic, you're not going to go to heaven. Well, just telling somebody, the conviction of the conscience that here is truth and I must adhere to it, that is what has to be achieved. And so the church makes no assumption regarding the ignorance of those who are baptized and outside the Catholic Church. In fact, she would assume that they are operating according to the way they were raised, the traditions that they learned, the teaching that they were taught. And obviously, for many who have come into the church who say, well, I had a very bad opinion of Catholicism. And then I studied what Catholicism had to say, and I found out what my opinion was wrong. You know, the proverbial Fulton Sheen saying, well, I've never met, I've met 10,000 people and made that many converts. I've never met a person who had disliked the Catholic Church because of something that they believed that was true about it. It's always an error.
Yeah.
They always believe wrongly what the church believes. So a minister who thinks that he's on the right course and he's doing the will of God to the best of his knowledge, hope and pray and that his heart will be open to the fullness of truth, that truth which leads to unity, which our Lord prayed for in the last at the Last Supper. Even practically, it's more likely that Methodists should join the Catholic Church than Catholic Church should all become Methodists. It's not a practical direction, and not even is it theologically correct, because history is on side of the origins of the Catholic Church at the Last Supper and at Pentecost. But hope and pray he comes to that conviction of conscience regarding it.
Andrea, thank you so much for your text. If you would like to text us, just text the letters EWTN to 55000. It's Open Line Friday with Colin Donovan here on EWTN. Let's go to one of the calls we received on our listener comment line.
For a Catholic who baptized baby, or have a baby baptized, parents are non-Catholic, and they agree to get him baptized Catholic with two Catholic godparents, if that's possible in the Catholic Church.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's not enough detail there. That the difficulty is that it's the parents that will raise the child, not others. And the parents are the ones who have to promise to that the child will be raised a Catholic. So there are a lot of difficulties with there. I would say that in all such cases where somebody has a desire to baptize a child, that you go to the local parish or the local diocese and talk to the priest about it. That's the context.
Yeah.
The church does not favor bathtub baptisms, certainly not the baptisms of other children. Those have actually been ruled invalid on when they've been done against the will of the parents. And so you want to make sure you're doing it right, because what's right will please the Lord.
Sure.
The Lord has a plan for the salvation of the child. We don't have to short circuit that plan by jumping in and thinking, if I don't do this, nobody else is going to do it, or it's not going to happen. No, trust in God. But certainly go and ask the question of the church as well.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. Speaking of baptism, just got a text from John who says, the recent news of the priest who wasn't validly baptized, why was that a big deal? Wouldn't God understand that it was just an honest mistake?
Well, he certainly does. It's still a big deal because we're obliged by the forms which that same God created. Unless you are baptized, unless you are born again by water and the Holy Spirit. And so baptism is the foundation of the Christian life. Now, imagine if the church said, oh, yeah, here's an exception. Goodwill suffices. There actually was a Catholic newspaper, not in this country, that unbelievably scolded the Archdiocese of Detroit for this, you know, basically a kind of a legalism and all of that. No, it's not a legalism at all. It's obedience to the words of Christ. Because what happens once the church says, well, you know, it's not really baptism, it's not necessary. Pretty soon, baptism's not necessary.
Yeah, yeah.
It's either necessary as means or it isn't. Now, the church doesn't say that baptism is absolutely necessary for salvation. It says it is necessary as a means because we're obliged by the forms that Christ established. If somebody dies a martyr, the church recognizes that person as having the equivalent of baptism, baptism of blood. If a person dies while on their way to becoming a Christian, a Catholic, and being baptized, and that was their intention, but sickness or accident takes their life, then that's recognized. It's a baptism of desire. And those who outside the church are goodwill, as Blessed Pius IX said, we can leave them to the judgment of God as to what where they stand before him. But we ourselves are obliged by what Christ said. And once we start saying, well, here's a case, the goodwill suffices, then you've thrown all of that out and we are the judges.
Yeah.
And that makes us dogmatic Protestants, because Protestantism is basically self-interpretation.
Sure.
So this would be self-interpretation to say, oh, that doesn't matter. No, we have a long tradition that it does matter because Christ said, this is how you must do it. What God does, like forgiving the thief on the cross, that's God.
Sure.
We do what we've been asked to do by God.
John, thank you so much for your text. Just got another text. This is actually from YouTube. Anna Marie wants to know, was it illegal back in the day for a Roman citizen to be crucified?
I don't know that it would be illegal if you deserve crucifixion. I don't think anyone after it was done would say, naughty, naughty, and you're going to be crucified yourself for it. Mm. But Roman citizens were given the dignity of a swift death. And crucifixion was not a swift death.
Yeah.
Jesus' 3 hours on the cross was exceptionally brief compared to most, because he was exceptionally brutalized, of course.
Yeah.
So how did the Roman citizen be put to death? As Paul was in Rome, by the sword, so that it was swift and quick. Countries have done the same thing. You know, if you were a heretic, and you confessed your error, they might still cut off your head, but they wouldn't torture you first.
Right.
And so that's sort of a bad continuation of that mentality. But yes, they did accord the privilege, if you want to call it that, of a swift death to the Roman citizen.
Okay. Very good. And here's a question from Ben. This is rather interesting. Why does the bread that is used in the Mass have to be specifically made for the Mass to be valid? And after all, does it even have to be bread? Could it be something else?
Well, again, the forms, including the matter, is determined by our Lord, and he took bread and he blessed it and he broke it and gave it to his disciples as the words of institution repeat. So we use bread. We don't use rice cakes. We don't use rye. Although I guess that's a bread. We has to be bread, or what common opinion calls bread.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why we use it. It does have to be that. The reason there's some control over that is you can imagine that people can get very silly in this regard. In fact, we've seen it in our lifetime, haven't we, Tom?
Oh, yes, definitely.
People get silly and they think, well, I don't want this bland old leavened bread. I'll make a raised bread. That's actually valid material, valid matter, although it's not listed in the Roman Rite. It's the practice of the Eastern churches, including the Catholic Eastern churches. Or they think, well, let's not give this bland flavor. Let's, you know, sort of perk it up with cinnamon or, you know, something else. That does invalidate it. So that's why there are rules both for the wine and for the bread. It's not necessarily that somebody might make bread that wouldn't be valid, but it's that if you follow the formula, it would be valid. If you stray from it too far, we don't know when it wouldn't be valid. And so we must absolutely confect the sacraments, not maybe it's valid.
Very good. Hey, Colin Donovan, fast-moving hour. Thank you, sir.
It was. Wow.
Absolutely. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We hope all of our listeners have a wonderful weekend. Keep it right here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Got a lot of great stuff for you straight ahead. You don't want to miss a moment of it. I'm Tom Price. Have a wonderful weekend, and God bless.